welcome to In-Game Chat for Saturday, March 2nd, 2013. This is Season 7, Episode 5. I'm Scott.
I'm James.
And I'm Matt.
And welcome to the show. If you'd like to get in touch with us, our phone number is 334-272-9228. That is 334-272-9228. You can find us on Twitter at In-Game Chat, as well as on Facebook. You can email us, everyone, at ingamechat.net, or you can find our forums over at colonyofgamers.com. We're streaming the cam feed right now through our Ustream account. You can find us there, or you can hit up our Facebook page and watch from there and join in the chat room. So lots of ways to get in touch with us. Also, we've got our Steam group going on, and we've got, I think it's about 60 members over there right now. So you can find us on Steam as well and join in the group and play games and have discussions there as well as about the show or any game you're playing. Doesn't matter. Just feel free to talk about whatever. In the second hour of the show tonight, we're going to be bringing in Neil Sorens from Zen Studios. He's the creative director over there. He'll be on the phone with us to talk about Star Wars Pinball and answer your questions as well. If you have any, you can hit us up in the chat room. Before that, though, we had a packed show last week, and we didn't get a chance to go through the mailbag, so we're going to start this episode off and dive right into the emails. Had a few emails from and about a longtime listener to Bakov Fan, who is incidentally not in the chat room. He's normally in there, but not in there this weekend. He writes to us first about the PS4. This was before they had made their announcement. Nab was just running through some ideas. His first thought was, what if Half-Life 3, or Episode 3, was a PS4 launch title?
He described that as his fever dream.
Yes.
Something that he considered to be extremely unrealistic. I consider it to be merely unrealistic, not extremely so.
Slightly plausible?
Maybe a little bit. I don't know. That plausibility exists only because Gabe Newell decided to associate himself a year ago with Sony at E3 for the purpose, or was it two? It was 2 years ago.
It's two. It's right at, yeah, Portal 2, I guess.
For the purposes of demonstrating the fact that they're willing to do business with Sony because of their low garden wall. So it's not out of the question. I think the most interesting thing about his question is that Anywhere where there's development and uncertainty, anywhere there's the expectation of an announcement in the games industry, we find a way, as people who are interested in these things, we find a way to insert Half-Life 3.
Of course.
Or Episode 3 into it. Any crack in the pavement and a little weed of hope regarding Half-Life, the future of it in whatever way, starts to peek out of it. Yeah, it happens every time in every place. Mm-hmm. It is just like Wesker sunglasses.
And every time we're always disappointed.
Well, yeah.
At this point, I'm not really disappointed. I'm just expecting it not to happen.
Your
really.
Stance is one of eternal disappointment, of consistent, unending disappointment regarding that. There was a point in time when we thought it must happen. It has to happen. Of course it's going to happen. They're working on it. They're going to develop it. They're going to release it. They're going to make it.
And we got all the way to Episode 2.
Sure.
And as I understand it, it ended perfectly, you know, suggestible for Episode 3 or whatever.
Which is
the
to say
was.
That it ended horribly.
Yeah. But it left the notion that, yes, okay,
further episodes will come out.
Three is coming, yes.
Not only are they possible, but they're absolutely necessary in order to finish telling
right.
that particular
That's
story.
That's what I was trying to say. You do yeah. it so much better.
Just any little place in the world. We already know that it's unlikely there's going to be enough of a disparity between, at least for a while, let me say this, there's going to be a window of time long enough where Half-Life 3 and or Episode 3, Half-Life the next, mm-hmm. Can appear both on consoles and on PC without too many compromises being made. You know, we're going to have that period of time. Portal the first came out
2007?
It was 7 or 8?
It was October.
It was 2007.
It was October.
It was really just 7. A couple of years into the lifespan of the 360. And Portal was perfectly wonderful and playable on the 360. There weren't really any problems whatsoever. It looked perfectly fine. It played perfectly fine. Portal 2 even played, I suppose, perfectly fine on the consoles. You played it on the PS3, didn't you?
I did. Beat it on the PS3 and then later got it, well, because it came with the Steam code for the PC. So I got it for both PC and PS3 and beat it on both. And yeah, it played perfectly well. I enjoyed it.
It should be fine. There's actually no reason not to think that he wouldn't do something like that, particularly if, as we expect or hope, the Sony's PlayStation Network is actually gonna take a few steps toward. I don't like to say openness. Open isn't a word that I'm really ready to associate with any of the networks that the console manufacturers use. But it's more cooperative, more. Mm-hmm. More engaging, more outward-looking?
Well, yeah. I mean, everything they talked about, every time they said that digital, 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 that was my relationship to Steam. And every time they said stream, 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 that was my relationship to OnLive. Both of which I've had rather very good experiences with and understand how they work. And
Steam is my only
comparison.
Sure.
You know?
There's stuff other than Steam, although most of those other platforms have taken Steam's lead.
Right.
Or followed it, rather. OnLive was perfectly... It was fine. It was nascent, you know? Nothing about it actually felt complete. Nothing about it felt like it was the best version of itself. But
what it was doing was better than I expected it to be doing.
That really was. We had a lot of fun with it, which is why I was sort of happy about some of the features that the PS4 is going to be using. Seemed to be the next logical step on from what OnLive was doing. But back to his point... The more I think about it, the less likely I am to believe that it's out of the question. A launch title, that's a bit much.
An eventuality?
Possibly within the first couple of years of its release. I don't know. I'm trying to create fertile ground for my own hopes regarding the next Half-Life. I need it to happen. Even if it's the last thing that ever happens, I need something, if you please.
A dying man's wish.
Would you kindly give me some more Half-Life?
Well, the next email comes from Daniel Phelps, and it's about Nabokov fan. He and Nab have been playing some games together. He says originally that he was a little hesitant to do so, since all the games Nab wanted to play were things that Daniel felt completely out of place playing. They played Counter-Strike Source. Nab actually bought him a copy of Ruse, and then they played Half-Life 2 mod called Zombie Master, which he says felt like Left 4 Dead 4. Or Left 4 Dead, but with an actual person playing the director. Daniel says he ended up having a ton of fun playing those and getting those new experiences in, and something he would never have done had Nabokov fan not opened him up to those games. He's grateful for that. And then he went on to suggest something that we took to heart and actually did something about. We created our Steam group based off of this email. Jeremy actually created the Steam group there. He saw that and he thought, that's a great idea. I thought it was a perfect idea as well, and Jeremy got the ball running. And so we are on Steam with a Steam group. Feel free to join our group and play games with the listeners there, or talk about the games that you're playing. You can talk about the show stuff. Doesn't have to be show related. In fact, you know, James was talking earlier about some mod packs he found, and he'll put them up in the discussions things for anybody that's playing that particular game. We'll get to that a little bit later on in the show.
More than that being an object of our focus, I think it's probably a good place since it is a, you know, it's a Steam group. It's a place where it's a social construct inside of what you use to play your games. I think it's a really good way for anybody out there who's interested, yet another pathway, rather, for you to influence our conversation.
Exactly.
For you to have some effect on what you want us to talk about.
We're all over the place for that. So, another email from Daniel concerned game music. He says he hasn't played many games in the past year that had great atmospheric music. I would agree with him on that. The original Deus Ex was his best example of great atmospheric music that did a lot for the game itself. Human Revolution also did a good job of this. He also mentions that Hotline Miami and Faster Than Light had great music that just fit, as well as Metal Gear Solid on the original PlayStation. He asks if we've played any games recently that has music that helps immerse us into the world, and have we ever experienced a game that had music that was just so perfect for that and only that game?
For the first part of that, I like the music for BioShock. I really enjoyed that.
You're talking about the score, or are you talking about...
The score.
Just the... Okay.
And even, like, because they
all,
did...
Just all the aspects of the music
I think it fit really well with the world of Rapture. Some of my favorite game music that I think just fits perfectly into the game was Grim Fandango. Had that upbeat jazz that was really into that world. And, you know, when I think about the game a lot, you know, I could hear this, the musical scores, during certain parts of the game, and that's one that really hit me that I've always enjoyed.
I know, for me, it's always been the missed games. I've enjoyed those games. I guess if you're a fan of the game, you're probably a fan of almost all aspects of what that game has to offer, and so the music would be included in that. But so far, I've owned every soundtrack for every missed game that has released so far. Even the multiplayer one they did, the Uru. A little side-off project that they did there. I even grabbed the soundtrack for that. I've always enjoyed that. Sound for that game was particularly important, I guess you could say, because you were, you know, when James talks about Tomb Raider being a very lonely game, there's another one, Myst, a very lonely game. And so the music was there to help you and to... just provide that atmosphere. I'm big into atmospheric stuff. So in relation to that, games like Dead Space, the first Dead Space, that really didn't, it did have a score with it, but it was more the sound effects that were used that helped you become immersed or to scare the crap out of you, really. It was the sounds in that game that really did that, but not that I would ever go out and buy a soundtrack of those noises at all.
Can you imagine that? You know, either driving down the road with your earbuds in, or trying to go to sleep with the sound of necromorph bones banging off the insides of air ducts all around you.
Man.
You know, if you can go to sleep to that.
Better person than I.
I suppose so. You're maybe a worse person. I don't know.
I had the soundtrack, I remember, back in the day for the original Silent Hill, and that would just sometimes, I'd just put my music on random, and just like that would come up, you know, just like the Silent Hill score, or, you know, the initial, and instantly, sometimes the music, it really strikes you, and it just freaks you out.
I think, just looking to the past year, roughly, I really... It wasn't my favorite out of the series, but Mass Effect had wonderful music. It had exceptional music. It really, really fit the swell and the change of pace, the speed, and then the slowdown of all the different emotional moments. There were a lot of times when you felt the music was like really charged. It was heroic. It was patriotic. In a form, it was the sort of thing you expect to underscore a determined hero. But there was also a lot of stuff that was, particularly in the third, the score in the third game had a tendency to draw in a lot of the atmospheric sounds, which were being used to reinforce the concepts of impending doom and everything that the hero Shepard was working toward. The various, you'll probably remember exactly what I'm talking about, but the way that the score sort of worked with the sounds the Reapers made, that long bass,
mechanical, heavy distorted.
Yeah, it was mechanical, but it was like a low strings kind of thing. It was very nightmarish, very low frequency stuff that kind of, you know, ran through your gut and made you feel not particularly good. It was a big, deep, heavy sound.
Yeah.
And I thought that their integration of all that stuff was really, really great. And I've liked the score and the themes throughout the entire series. They did a wonderful job. And while not the music that affects me the most, I mean, and you want to talk about music, I am the very model of a scientist, Solari, and it's probably one of the best original pieces of work, or certainly based on something else.
Right.
But you know, it was clever. There was a lot of creativity in that. I think I'm going to have to spend a lot of time in various ways defending that game in retrospect. I think we're getting too comfortable not appreciating it for
what
the,
it did.
The 99 things it did correct.
And that,
more than correct.
Right, yeah.
Overall, I think the soundtrack that has probably stuck with me the most and for the longest is Homeworld, the original Homeworld.
Oh, yeah, that was
soundtrack.
Great.
I can be made to feel like I'm standing in the middle of a scorching desert when I'm in empty space. You know, there were a lot of Near East, Middle Eastern themes in that music. You know, because of the origin planet that the race you played, K-2. came from. They were the desert people.
Right.
So I find myself somewhere between Battlestar Galactica, Lawrence of Arabia, and, you know, I don't know what, like, on Tatooine. I don't know. It was really magnificent. It was a really, really well-done score. Absolutely fantastic. It could transport me.
Well, it just goes to show the appreciation of game music that has come. I mean, we have Video Games Live, for one thing, that has been touring since 08 or something like that. They've been doing it for, years now, doing tours of this, and it's nothing but, you know, live video game music being performed. And so
when I read his emails, I actually went back and listened to my Video Games Live. The CD, and just to, like, get a little familiarization with it again.
But you have a whole concert of nothing but video game music being performed for you.
That's fantastic. So, the one that still, you know, I could think every, you know, instance in my head is Zelda. Just the Zelda theme is one of my favorites.
Well, yeah, you've got your classics that you'll fall back on. We've got a couple of them that we use for bumpers coming in and out of the show that automatically hit that, oh, yeah, I played this for years and years, you know, as I was growing up type stuff, especially when you go back to the old 8-bit days. It's actually very fun because you can, I see what they say because they're labeled on the screen, but watching the two of you or anybody else in here saying, I see that name that tune thing going on in your head being like, is this from? But for the most part, they're dead on, and you can figure it out. But you know, if you've got suggestions, if you've got more music that you would like for us to add into our little stuff, it doesn't. It only plays a few times during the show, but you're more than welcome to send us some clips. Don't send us an entire
album
CD of the same. We only need one track from your favorite game. Basically, is all we need. Not the entire album of music, but that would be great if you want to send those in. Everyone at ingamechat.net, and we'll throw them into the rotation of the show. I was going to go over to something that doesn't necessarily have to provide. It's a nice juxtaposition to the orchestration stuff. Every time EA started doing this with Burnout games. Actually started doing this with SSX and Burnout and a couple of their games. They put in that EA soundtrack thing or whatever, where it would play artist songs while you're doing the races or anything like that, and I could not stand that. For whatever reason, I just couldn't stand it. I either had to put in my own music, which was, you know, for Burnout, it was like, you know, action themes, a lot of Hans Zimmer, that sort of stuff.
I remember coming over to your house and every
and listening
time
to Pirates of the Caribbean.
It would be either the Pirates of the Caribbean soundtrack or The Rock. Something like that.
Exactly.
And they fit.
They did wonderfully, didn't they?
Strangely good fit.
Yeah.
I'm not entirely sure why that is. But
chase music, basically, is all you would have. But chase music, for me, is not Avril Lavigne or whatever they were. That's the only one I can remember. Nickelback, whoever. But that's not.
I never knew any of the artists.
Right. I couldn't. I just didn't have that. It didn't connect for me. Luckily, they had an option where you could turn that off, and the guys at Criterion actually threw in the soundtracks, their originally produced music that they used in Burnout 2, Burnout 3, and Burnout Revenge that they used. They put those in Burnout Paradise, so you could switch completely over to that and turn off all the EA tracks, as it was called. You could completely turn that off and just listen to that. And I did that, and it made the game so much better for me. It's racing, so you're really not paying attention to music cues, but there's something to be said for how well. It's a lot like that comparison that I've always seen done, where they show you the Jaws clip of the shark, and then they say, "Well, here's the Jaws clip of the shark with the music." So,
right,
there's the racing, and that you can get tense because you're about to crash and all other stuff. But when you add music, that multiplies the intensity.
It not only does it multiply the intensity, but it has a bit of a. It's like its own modifier, and you can modify by something less than whole number percentages, because I'm telling you, you want to get through something really, really scary. You want to get through some of those rooms in Amnesia. You put on Yakety Sax, and it's going to help a lot. I'm serious. I don't doubt.
I just never. Why I never thought of that before was like, oh, that's perfect to get me through some of these games.
I have an emergency Yakety Sax track. for those special times.
I'm going to have to do that now.
I don't know. I'm wondering if we have Yakety Sax here in case anybody doesn't know.
Yeah, Benny Hill.
I know, yeah. Just YouTube Yakety Sax, and you'll know exactly what it is. But
right, and then get, you know, go to like one of the YouTube mashup sites or something. Pick a really scary scene, have Yakety Sax run alongside it, and realize that you'll absolutely be able to get through that segment of Dead Space or Amnesia. Or I was actually very much thinking about it today with the game I was playing that we will talk about in a little more than an hour.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that a minute ago. I was like, I can get through that game and not have to worry about it. I guess. I don't know. Some games may hold up against, regardless of the music, it still may have that effect. But then again, it's Yakety Sax. It'll do the trick on wiping out any kind of seriousness of anything. It can turn anything into a comedy for the most part.
So far, it hasn't let me down exactly. And it makes you run fast. I'm pretty serious about that. I'm pretty sure that the run speed in any game is buffed when you play Yakety Sax, just like a Benny Hill chase scene.
Well, we're going to go, we're going to get into more. We've got a couple more emails that we're going to get into, and we're going to get into those after we come back with more here on Endgame Chat. We'll be right back. To in-game chat. Speaking of music, there you go. That's from Uncharted right there.
Which one is that from? Which game specifically?
I believe it's from the first.
Okay.
It's just Nate's theme, which I think is just carried over.
Yeah, I know, but it's orchestrated slightly differently in each one. So.
Actually, I'll tell you where that came from. That came from Amazon had a sale on the London Philharmonic Orchestra, the whatever it was, the best video game music tracks of all time. They got Volume 2 out now, so, but that was from Volume 1. I picked it up for 99 cents, I think.
Mm. Oh, wow.
For like 12, 13 tracks in it, so.
I don't have a whole lot of memory of the Uncharted soundtracks overall, but that bit right there, the
mm-hmm.
that theme.
The theme that's carried over into every single title, yeah.
Yeah, that's one of the most finely crafted, most perfectly crafted themes for a game, particularly a game that is so cinematic in all of its appeal.
Mm-hmm.
That theme right there is 90% of what John Williams could do. You know, it's really there. It actually, I remember telling you this a long time ago.
I think I know what you're about to say.
When I wasn't really particularly energized about Uncharted 3, and I was like, oh, I'm just.
And I think you put the game in the system, and it did that.
I was like, I'm just not there. I don't want to. I love you, Nate, but I'm not really that excited about your third adventure. I don't entirely believe in what we're doing here. Two is enough. I'm just not into it. And I put it in, and that theme cranked up, and I was exactly where Naughty Dog wanted me.
Mm-hmm.
At that moment, it was absolutely brilliant.
Now, during the break, you probably saw on the webcam us, you know, chatting all over the place during the 5 minutes or 4 minutes that we took a commercial break, where even during those 4 minutes or so, so much was said about game music again that I was like, well, we should probably bring that up because we can just carry on that conversation for a little bit longer. But you guys were talking about the Fallout series, correct?
Well, in two different things actually occurred to me over the break. One is that despite the fact that they're really not that relevant anymore, we haven't had a solid Final Fantasy experience in a long time. But two of the major composers for that series, Yasunori Mitsuda and Nobuo Uematsu, who also did a lot of the Chrono Cross
and Chrono Trigger,
the Chrono series. Those are pure orchestrations, and they're not really designed to underscore dialogue or cinematics or anything like that. They're the kind of thing that you're going to find underscoring pretty much the entire experience because they weren't running back before FF10, you know, FF9 and previous. All these games were text only. There was no spoken dialogue. So a lot of the emotion of the moment, as music always does, was really carried by the music. But those orchestrations were unbelievable. Final Fantasy IX's soundtrack can bring me to tears, which makes no sense. But it's one of the most melancholy, emotional, not dour, you know, not horrible, but truly melancholy things, which really helped to temper an otherwise really optimistic game, a really happy and upbeat game for a Final Fantasy game. And I just to this day, I have to make sure that I'm in absolutely the right mood before I listen to it, or it can take me to like a really just sort of a strange place. Very, very important music. But at the other end of the spectrum, yeah, we were talking about the curated selections of existing music for Fallout 3 and New Vegas in particular.
Just how the New Vegas soundtrack, the songs that they chose, just really helped out the game so well. Where some of them were about the casino and the Rat Pack. And
yeah, I mean, it's one thing when you can produce music that is tailored to whatever the story is or the game or the setting or whatever the case, but to reach into already existing libraries and licensed tracks to put into your game to say, we want to emote this feeling of where our setting is, you've got to be very
selective,
good at picking those tracks.
To me now, when I hear Johnny Guitar or Big Iron, I automatically, I picture the desert, and it really fits that mood so well.
Some of these songs that have been around for the better part of a century now, right? At what point in time previously, in decades past, would you have listened to Bing Crosby and thought,
or the Inkspots?
One of these days, I'm telling you, when I'm on an adventure at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, or when I'm in an impossible post-apocalyptic wasteland out west, or in the remains of Washington, D.C., this is going to be the music of my time. It's going to be the soundtrack of my life in that experience. It's because they don't have an apparent connection, and they were just, it's perfectly curated. It doesn't have to be orchestrated to really put you where you need to be. But those were other fantastic examples. And the difference there is that I think you could actually go grab a Final Fantasy soundtrack and listen to it and really appreciate it for the piece of orchestration it is. But you can't, you can't exactly, you will never understand what any of those pieces of music from either Fallout 3 or Fallout New Vegas mean if you listen to them in isolation. You'll have a different experience with them. But crawling through some empty, half-destroyed building that's infested with ghouls of some sort or another, or a death claw nest, or any of the things that you would come across, while listening to some otherwise very cheery and happy doo-wop or something, is one of it. It's such
a, it's like a Scorsese film.
Yeah, it's a chocolate and peanut butter moment.
Yeah, it is,
that I've never had before. I was like, what are these two flavors? It's lamb and mint jelly. I'm telling you.
Dennis in the chat room mentioned Alan Wake, and that's a perfect. That's a great example of picking tracks to just comp when Roy Orbison hit at the end of episode one.
That's got to be one of the best endings for a first chapter. It was perfect, perfect.
Yeah,
I like the post song. I think it was on chapter two.
I don't remember chapter two. I know I finished chapter two, but boy, I tell you, chapter one still sticks with me. I still remember finishing that and having that Roy Orbison track hit. So
dreams.
Yes, great, just great music. Dennis, get to the show, would you? I know you got that job thing going on, but we'd love to have you in the room with us. Just a few hours before last week's show, we got an email from Gersnort, my favorite screen name of everybody's. He starts by saying that he was watching an old Looney Tunes cartoon, as I want to do as a 30-year-old man baby, as he puts it. No worries, Josh, as a 34-year-old man baby, I immediately found the cartoon in question, and I watched it before reading your email further. It's called Curtain Raiser. If you're curious and you want to watch it as well, that's the name of it. You can find it on YouTube. If that's the case, here's a little bit of a spoiler warning. It's a short where a bunch of characters are auditioning for Porky Pig, and the final audition turned out to be a great one that Porky liked and was one where a guy just blew himself up. Afterwards, he comes back into the room as a ghost, claiming that the only problem with the act is that he can only do it once. This got Josh to thinking, Gersnort, to thinking about how games could relate to the short. Porky, as a video game consumer, has all these piles and piles of entertainment, good and bad. And as soon as he gets to the last option, he finds it's amazing and he wants more, except he can't have that. He could if he committed to another character, but in the end, it just would not be the same. It made him wonder if there were games he's played that he can only experience once, and if followed up by a sequel, would it feel hollow and cheap by comparison? The most recent examples he had was Diablo 3. A lot of time put into it, but nowhere near the time he put into Diablo 2, and the same goes for Street Fighter 4 when compared to Street Fighter 2 or 3. In future sequels, he looks to Deus Ex Human Revolution. He loved the game, but he just can't bring himself to go back and do it all over again. And he says a sequel to the game, which is rumored that we got this week, he doesn't see himself enjoying it to the same degree as the first. His fear now sits with Bioshock Infinite. No doubts about it being outstanding, but since they are dealing with whatever.
Gentle
ideas.
Let's welcome the live audience to Scott's
exactly
first return to one of his major problems. He's not so good with the words a lot of times.
That was dealt with in the original Bioshock. He worries that the impact is going to be lost on him. And that was the gist of his email there. Any games that you've had where you just can't go back to them?
Well, yeah.
Plenty.
Yeah.
Tons. For me, I can tell you right now, for me, I don't know of any game that I could tell you I could go back to. Puzzle games, racing games, that's one thing, but an actual game with a linear story and a character you have to play through, I don't know.
I will tell you, the less engaging the story is. If the gameplay is really solid, but the story is by the numbers, A to Z kind of affair, and I like it, I'm actually more likely to be able to go through it again, just because if I went through Human Revolution twice as an example, and I it was really fun. The variations really weren't what you would expect, not if you had played the original game, but it was good. I enjoyed it. The gunplay was fun, the powers were fun, and my second time through I didn't take myself seriously. You know, first time I did, second time I just let myself be ridiculous. I used all of the powers that I felt interfered with the type of game I wanted the first time through. And it was really, really good. But something like the games we just mentioned, the Fallouts, I can't. I can never do it. I got absolutely everything I needed out of my first time through. I made the decisions I wanted to make. I allied with the people I wanted to. I stole from who I intended to steal from. Killed who needed killing, saved who deserved to be saved, in my opinion. And that was about it. And I spent oodles of time in those games, hundreds and hundreds of hours between, you know, the games themselves and the expansion material. I don't want to do it again. Skyrim was close enough, and I hear tales about people who've spent about as much time as I have in Skyrim, but they've done it on 7-8 different characters. I can't do. There's some experiences that were so perfectly tailored to me. They were the perfect outcome of what I do that I don't want to try to weave that particular tapestry anymore.
Yeah, the guys in the chat room are bringing up Walking Dead. I haven't
played that through a second time. I mean, the one time.
I think once you go through that and get to the ending, I think that is your, I'm like, this is how I want it to end.
Because yeah, that's the picture you painted.
You make that choice, and it's not, you kind of don't want, I'll admit to having sought out, not YouTube videos, just hit up forums and said, well, what happens if I did this, this, and this, and this? I didn't necessarily want to go through it again to figure that out. It was just a curiosity, but there's a satisfaction that comes from that last choice. You've been through so much so far that last choice is, I mean, that's it. That is the point of the game, is to get you to that last choice and to have that last choice be the impact that it's supposed to have. Doing it again, knowing where you're going to get, that choice doesn't have that same impact. It's a perfect example of what he was saying, where you can do it again, but it's just never like it was the very first time.
Mm-hmm. I love adventure games. They're one of my favorites, but it's one of those things like, how can I play Monkey Island again? I know the puzzles, and once you know a puzzle, exactly how to solve it, it's sort of just going through the motions.
It's a lot like that with Myst, is that I just can't go back into that. I've already done it. I know the puzzles. I mean, you can go for speed runs and stuff, and that's one thing if you've got an objective to do, but to have that same experience, it's just not there anymore.
Yeah. I mean, The Dig was a fantastic game, but every now and then I have it on my Scum virtual machine, and I'll load it up, but I just get to the opening, you know, get done with the opening credits, and, you know, I'm like, I know exactly what happens through every step of the way because I played it, you know, a couple of times over. I'm like, all right, so I'll just close it out.
Yeah, Annie Aiko in the chat room, Coop, he mentioned Heavy Rain. That's, I mean, compared to Walking Dead, that's Walking Dead's a quick day, you know, not even a day, like an hour, 2 hours worth of playing just to get through that. Heavy Rain's a nice chunk of time to have to go back through, and it does have some branches, but it still puts you to a point where choices do have to be made, and consequences come from those choices. So, again, once you get to that point, you've made the decision, you've played it through, and you've gotten your thing. I suppose the difference there being is that there are so many different endings on that you can find certain save points and go back to and say, because if it didn't end the way you wanted it to, your character got shot or somebody else got shot or whatever the case.
There was a little bit of branching there.
You jump back to that save point and say, that's not what I wanted to happen. I missed my timing on the QTE, mm-hmm. you know, and so you can go back and fix that, but...
That absolutely was the story of my Heavy Rain mm-hmm. experience. I had a terrible outcome. Everybody died. Even people who can't die died. I think some of the developers died on my playthrough of Heavy Rain. It was that bad.
But at least, you know, that game and Walking Dead had some branching. I mean, there's only one way Roger Wilco will ever go through Space Quest 2 and live. I mean, other than, like, dying and resetting. So, I mean, those old adventure games, they didn't even have any kind of branching whatsoever. And once you know the puzzle for it, there, you know, mm-hmm. you can only do it once.
There's a lot of games like that, but there are, I mean, but then you look at an MMO where you roll a character, you get there, and then you roll some other character.
It is a little bit different because those are multiplayer games,
right?
And the character that you play it's not an RPG, and it's not about choices. It's about the role, mm-hmm. the player role that you will fulfill in group play.
Yeah, so they kind of sit in a bubble outside of the discussion. I mean, they're still in that discussion, but they kind of sit on the outside of that because they offer new experiences. They offer experiences with other people at the same time, so you're almost always guaranteed to get some slightly new, well, loot and stuff like that. You'll get something new of it.
Oh, sure. In the broader discussion of replayability, you know, long-term value of any particular game, single-player versus multiplayer, such like that. It's worth talking about them, but when we're really looking down at cherished, you know, otherwise, it's an unfortunate term, but like very precious mm-hmm. single-player experiences in particular, in a lot of cases, if you're happy with what you had, it's best to just push back, uninstall, leave it in your Steam list, but get it off your hard drive and just keep the memories, you know.
Look at the icon and remember.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, there's been many a time. I look at the icon and I remember, and I also think I really should try that again. I say that to myself. It just never comes to pass. But so, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of experiences like that that you'll find in games. And what about sequels that he was talking about? I mean, Bioshock Infinite was one of his examples.
Well,
Deus Ex.
I think, you know, anybody who... All right, now, let me point out that with Deus Ex, and the Bioshock Infinite, these are modern manifestations of relatively old games. Mm-hmm. Deus Ex and System Shock 2 come from essentially within six months of each other. And Human Revolution is a sort of a prequel, minor retelling of the Deus Ex story. Bioshock was
the spiritual successor,
essentially the spiritual, maybe side grade to System Shock. You know, to the Shock name. That's how I'm approaching Infinite. I don't even really expect them to be a part of the same world anymore than I expect any two Final Fantasies to be kind of contiguous within the same universe.
Whereas Bioshock 1 and 2 were direct, you know, those were more
right
in tune with each other. Where, yeah, like you said, Infinite.
In my opinion, it's like another movement in a symphony. You know what I mean? It's another variation on a very, very broad theme, which, and I know that. I pretty much know what to expect from it, but I know that I'm going in for something different, not necessarily the direct sequel. Direct sequels are a bit hit or miss. Sometimes I've come out of a game wanting to know exactly what happens next, and I've gotten nothing for it. Mm-hmm. But when it does show up, I'm very disappointed. Infamous was like that for me.
Assassin's Creed.
Has gotten progressively worse, in my opinion.
Well, I mean, the sequel, after one, we kind of wanted to know what all that stuff on the wall was, and then when two hit, we got a great experience out of
it. Yeah, I should say from two on, it has
but
gotten
then from
worse.
And then from then on, it's dragged a bit. It's never had that same impact and that same experience.
I think this isn't going to be entirely correct, but I think sometimes maybe sequelizing is the wrong idea, and some sort of improvisational kind of thing, some sort of development of the theme of the game. You know, I like what BioShock. I like what I perceive the relationship between BioShock and BioShock Infinite to be.
Mm-hmm.
They both operate within similar sets of rules, but they're not tied to telling a single continuous story. Those things have a tendency to break down. Entropy shows up really fast in a game sequel. And that's not necessarily good for the story, for the gameplay, for the setting, for anyone. So just say what you got to say. Say what you need to say in your one game, in your one story, and then move on to a new thing. Don't give me six seasons in a movie.
Right. Okay? I would say that and while we don't have the game yet, we've only seen video, but, you know, Assassin's Creed to Watch Dogs.
Yes. No. That's actually an excellent comparison. Mm-hmm. I made the joke, you and I were talking over the internet, when this, we're not going to really spend any time on it, but a rumor of the next Assassin's Creed game was in the wind. And I told you, the only thing I was really interested in was if Watch Dogs turned out to be the next Assassin's Creed game.
Right, just the evolution.
And they had just chosen to essentially distance them in everything but illusion, you know. It's like, they're kind of in the same world, but they're not really the same thing, and it's not a direct sequel because we're going the route of BioShock.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to play with the themes a little bit. I like that idea. I'm getting sequels get a little chewy, you know. They get a little bit tough. They're overheated. They're too many cooks in the kitchen, usually. Too many people trying to satisfy both their need to say what they want to say.
And the need for the fans to give.
The need for the fans to get whatever development they need from thing to thing. And sometimes embellishing where there's nothing worth embellishing on. Sometimes you've said all you've got to say. But, well, it made money, so we have to make more. Well, but there's nothing more to say.
Look at the original Tomb Raider line for that.
That'll be an interesting discussion for next week. And as homework, if you don't mind me mentioning, you may not be here, I would suggest, since Tomb Raider comes out on Tuesday, I'm going to try to play it.
Yeah, same here.
And I'm very interested, and I've had a kind of an off-again, on-again relationship with the Tomb Raider games as they've changed over time. Something I would suggest, particularly for you, Scott, is go to Game Trailers.
They're retrospective.
And they have a three-part retrospective of the Tomb Raider series. It's actually really fantastic.
I watched the whole five-part Metroid series a couple of weeks ago.
Right. I've seen every retrospective they've done.
They're fantastic.
Really done well.
This one's really timely, particularly since the Tomb Raider we have now is yet another restyling of the game and the character and everything about it. And it's a restyling of both the gameplay and the character, which isn't something they've really done yet. So
ever, no.
If anybody out there has any interest in these kinds of things, I would suggest it. It's enlightening, and it may help you take a more kind of humane approach toward the people who are trying to do what they're doing with this new game, and maybe be a little bit less aggressive about it. They're never going to make the first game again. It's impossible.
Yeah.
It's the best one they've ever done, and so there you go. It's in the past. But that's another problem that you start to see is something like the Tomb Raiders, or again, in my opinion, something like the Assassin's Creed games. They're just unnecessarily embellishing a story that wants desperately to move forward, but they don't know where they're going. They don't have a clear path. They haven't hammered out what the story is going to be in an ultimate sense, so they become, I don't know if they're fearful, they certainly seems like it to me, but they become seemingly desperate to just spin themselves in circles and tell the same story over and over and over again, so they can keep releasing video games that people will pay for.
Well, it'll be a great discussion next week. I'm sure we'll tackle that, the the whole Assassin's Creed 4 thing. It'll be a great discussion for that, because there's some points that you're bringing up here that I'm like, oh, we should jump into those.
But no.
We got more stuff to get to here. The next email comes from Calgar99. He writes in about next gen and console pricing. He's expecting a pretty big price tag, at least from Sony's side of things, in relation to what we know about the system, and wonders if they'll take Microsoft's experiment from this generation and add a contract plan to keep the initial price low. Would we be tempted by such an offer? I mean, I would be tempted with it. It depends on what the price is, because I don't know. I'll stay away from a contract if I can. But, you know, if the price is up there and if they offer something that's subsidized.
Well, let's avoid the subsidy for a second and actually go to the simplest question, which is let's guess what the price will be, right? And if you want to do it based on what we actually know they're going to be offering, there's no reason to expect it to be anything like the price of the PS3. The PS3 was a lot of custom hardware, a lot of very specialized hardware that wasn't even remotely off the shelf. It was also the platform they were using to push brand new optical technology. They were pushing Blu-ray. They weren't just trying to give us a new gaming console. They were trying to take over the movie and media market. It mm-hmm. was a huge push that we've since sort of forgotten about, because that battle ended pretty quickly. But that system had to make up for the costs of developing the specialized cell architecture and for marketing and distributing and essentially trying to make up for the development of Blu-ray. Two of those things at the same time, on top of whatever cost you'd normally associate with a console
to jack the price up.
Right. And again, as a console, it had a hard drive built in, something the PS2 didn't have. It had Wi-Fi built in, something the PS2 didn't have. It had Bluetooth and wireless
controllers,
something the PS2 didn't have. Let's reflect back a little bit to 7 years ago. It was an expensive piece of kit, but it was not overpriced. There was a lot of goodie inside of that black box, and that stuff costs money. So it's very similar to the argument you hear a lot of times about Apple products. I don't believe that they're overpriced. They are merely expensive. Those two things are not the same thing. Having said that, looking at what we know the PS4 is going to have, a lot more off-the-shelf parts, a lot more emphasis not on what the hardware does, but what the services can do, I don't know that it'll even be necessary for them to consider the idea of subsidy, which, by the way, I think is an interesting concept. But even with Microsoft, it's nothing more than an experiment. Small scale, late in the life cycle, very little on the line. It's an experiment with them, not really anything else. And I don't know that concept has been quite proven enough. So I would prefer a non-subsidized piece of hardware. I would prefer a straightforward console. And if I were guessing, I would say there's no way it comes in a penny over $400. I can't see them justifying that. That's a little bit high. $300 would be rational and fair. Still a lot of money, but fair, I think, given what we know about it.
I don't know. Maybe you would get the $599 if they bundle it with the Vita.
That's okay. Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely sure. But that can't ever be considered the base cost of the system.
No.
Looking at base cost, non-subsidized, $300 would be lovely. I mean, it would be really, really lovely. And I don't see a whole lot of... They're not really adding anything in particular to the system beyond what they're already capable of doing. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. The step from PS2 to PS3 was significant in terms of what they put in the box. This time it isn't. A share button? What does that mean? You know? I mean, the controller is a little bit fancier. They do have dedicated processors for taking care of video encoding and uploading and management of downloads as well. All that stuff. But it's not new tech. It's just a new configuration of tech. And that doesn't justify insane expense, in my opinion. But that really is the big question mark right now from them.
It is. So. It's the big question mark from them and Microsoft themselves. What are you going to price? I mean, we don't even know what Microsoft system can do, what it is.
Yeah, no guesswork there. I would say maybe $300 to $400 for the base cost of the PS4. Total guesswork. This has to do with whether or not they're going to be savvy enough to undercut themselves in order to make sure that the thing gets out there, sell it at a loss,
right,
or at least at no profit. which is probably the case. And then maybe a Vita bundle. What's Vita retailing
Vita's
for now?
Vita's $250 right now. But I think it dropped in Japan to, I think, $200. I think they cut the $50.
It hasn't dropped here.
It has not dropped here.
They haven't even discussed a drop here.
But I don't know. I kind of see that happening eventually, sometime this year. Likely, maybe, with the release of the PS3, is that, here's...
There's no reason not to. The Vita's already out. It's already a known quantity.
Here's our unless they release a newer model of it and say here's the
Like a hardware refresh.
Yeah, something like that, you know.
I don't know. They haven't pushed enough units of the Vita. They haven't actually sold enough to justify a hardware refresh.
Right.
So they probably have a lot of inventory. They certainly have a lot of factory configuration designed to push the fabrication of what they have now. So it seems like it would be a good deal. That would be a little bit pricey. Probably something like $500. Mm-hmm. It would be a good time to have a price drop on the Vita.
Right.
Or to do a bundle at about $500. But again, it's all guesswork. We won't know. It's chess.
And we really don't know. We don't know when it's going to be announced. I know Nintendo didn't announce the price of the Wii U until September or October, I think, and the system released in November or something like that. It was way after E3. I mean, E3, it was like, here's what it can do. Here's the games it's got. And then it wasn't until September or October before we ever got a price. So I'm not sure when we'll get a price for one of these systems.
The closer it gets to the time of release, that's when I'm sure we'll get the price for it.
They'll wait as long as they possibly can. They'll finish off most of their specification talk at E3. They'll talk about partnerships, third parties, more exclusives. We will probably get to see the form factor of the machine itself.
Oh, that'd be nice.
Somebody will get some hands-on. That'll be that, and then my guess is heading into the fall, that's when we'll get our prices.
So, all right, well, we're going to take a break here, and when we come back, we're going to be talking with Neil Sorens from Zen Studios about Star Wars pinball in general. If anybody knows me very well, I love pinball, physical and virtual tables, so this is a very exciting for me to get to talk to somebody who makes those types of tables for a living and that sort of thing and has pinball in their blood just as much as me. But when we come back, we'll have him on the show, and you can send in your questions here. If you're in the chat room, you can ask questions in there. We'll try and keep an eye on those. But more of that all coming up next here on In-Game Chat. We'll be right back. And welcome back to In-Game Chat. Joining us on the line now, we have Neil Sorens from Zen Studios, who probably recognize that music being played.
Yeah, that's menu music.
That is. I thought you would get a kick out of that from Pinball Effects.
That's old school.
Yes, it was. That was before you guys released Pinball Effects 2, which was interesting when that was released, because basically it turned into basically just an arcade room where all your tables could be stored.
Yeah, that was the intention. After, you know, we had success with DLC and the first Pinball Effects, we figured, you know, why make people buy four tables they might not want up front in order to get to the DLC?
Yeah. Well, we appreciate you being on the show. Thank you for giving us time to talk to you about the Star Wars tables and pinball in general and everything that Zen's doing. And wanted to start with, basically, how did Zen Studios, how did they begin? And why pinball?
They were originally a division of Rubik Interactive, which is a Hungarian company that did software, mostly like PC stuff, some educational software, nothing really too interesting. Eventually, the current owners bought out. The company went independent and moved into console games. The studio director is a big pinball fan, and he felt like there was an opportunity with pinball at that time, and he felt like it was a game that the studio could make well. So we got into pinball and haven't looked back.
Well, I've enjoyed that you guys decided to stick with pinball, because I don't know. It's I have always, I don't know how, I don't know why the appeal is there for pinball for me. I really don't. I just have this attraction to it. I don't know what it is about it or why. I suppose it's all the secrets that can be built into that confined space with physical objects. Obviously, you work in the virtual world, and you can put moving characters in your games and that sort of thing, but I suppose that's what really drew me to it. I really can't tell you. Anybody tells that asks me, why do you like pinball so much? I honestly can't tell you why, but I just do. And I guess, what is your experience with pinball?
Well, when I was a kid, the only time I could play at the arcades was when I stole laundry quarters out of my mom's purse. And so since I wasn't very good at pinball, in order to get more money for my time, I'd play something that I was better at, like Pac-Man or Donkey Kong. But then as I got older and, I had the money to play actual pinball tables, like you said, it was just this really complicated machine, and, humans are naturally curious, so, figuring out how every little thing works, and the, simple to play, difficult to master aspect is fun as well.
Do you remember your first table that you ever played?
I think it was a Terminator 2.
Oh, wow.
I had watched previous people playing other tables previously, but that was the first one I actually put a quarter in and played.
My first, I can remember where and what. It was in Helena, Georgia. And the first table I ever played that I just kept putting quarters into because I was like, I want to make this happen type of stuff was... I think it's Williams, Funhouse.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
With that, it didn't creep me out at the time, but it creeps me out now to see that Rudy's head, the puppet thing that's in there, talking to you about the ball, and you shoot the ball into his mouth and that sort of stuff. Yeah, it's kind of creepy now to go back and look at it, but for whatever reason, that table stuck with me, and that's what got me hooked on pinball from there on out, so...
And yeah, that's good. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, it's just that I've never looked back since then. I've always been interested in tables, old and new.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They have a really good pinball museum out near where I live, Alameda, California,
mm-hmm.
Pacific Pinball Museum, and they've got really emphasized the old tables, like the real scores, and there's some really wacky designs, like flippers almost in the middle of the table.
I know. Well, you had was it Black Knight or Medieval? Was it Black Knight 2000 that had the dual table design?
Oh yeah, like the upper play field and the lower play field. But these, I mean, I'm talking about like old, like 1950s, 1960s.
Oh wow. Okay. These some of the vertical tables even.
Yeah, they've got some because it's related to pachinko. So
right.
The reason that pinball tables have flippers in the first place is because there were laws outlawing gambling devices, and when they put the flippers in, it became a game of skill.
That's right. So, that's right. I remember that. I remember there's a couple of great, if you're ever on Netflix, there's a couple of great pinball movies on there. Is it called Tilt? It's not called Tilt. What is it called? Special When Lit is one of the names of the pinball documentaries out there, and it goes into the history of how pinball was banned in most places because it considered gambling, and then they somehow were able to, obviously adding the flippers in, they were able to make it a game of skill. So going into the tables that you guys released, the Star Wars tables, how did that come about? I mean, is this Lucas coming to you guys, or is this you guys? I've heard stories where you guys really wanted to do Star Wars tables, and finally Lucas said, yes, sure, go ahead, you can make some tables.
Well, it was we've wanted to do licensed tables pretty much since we started making pinball. Since the licensed tables really kind of took over pinball in the 90s.
Yeah, they did.
And that's really what people want because you can condense a brand into just like all the warm fuzzy memories.
There's a familiarity with it. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So anyway, we wanted to make Star Wars and Marvel. All these other ones pretty much from the beginning. So we were knocking on Lucas's door for years. And, after we handled, they saw how we handled the Marvel stuff and, they started, they did the Angry Birds Star Wars. So they were more open to like these casual game licenses. And, so finally we sat down and hashed out the numbers and signed on the dotted line and finally got it going.
How did the design of the tables come about? Do you guys have meetings where you talk about what needs to be included and then build around that? Or does Lucas say, well, I mean, for instance, the three tables you have, Star Wars The Clone Wars, based on the animated series, Star Wars Boba Fett, based on the character, and then you've got Star Wars, what is it, episode, Empire Strikes Back?
Yeah, episode.
Episode, you know, based on just one particular film.
Yeah, so when we went to Star Wars initially, our pitch, we just gave them a kind of boring, straightforward pitch because we thought that's what they wanted to hear. So just, you know, one table per movie and then, you know, maybe something else later on. And they said, no, we'd rather you be more creative, dig into the expanded universe, that kind of thing. And, you know, so obviously we still have, you know, the table based on the film, Empire Strikes Back. Clone Wars, just for variety. So we got the, you know, the older audience, the younger audience, and Boba Fett let us dig into the expanded universe. He's a character that didn't really have a lot of screen time in the original films, but in the expanded universe and the spin-offs and such, he's gained quite a bit of popularity.
My next question was why these three particular tables? Is it because, I mean, for instance, why Empire Strikes Back and not New Hope?
Just because we liked it more.
No, I mean, and that's a perfectly valid answer. I was just curious if there was something where, you know, the events of this film, for whatever reason, I don't know that this makes any sense what I'm about to say, the events of this film translate better to a pinball table. I have no idea what that's supposed to mean, but I didn't know if that's how your selection process kind of worked. What, this has more action scenes that we can throw in there, or, you know, whatever.
Episode 5 had the broadest offering of settings.
Yeah.
Of any of the original
Asteroid
films.
Belt, Hoth, Cloud City, Dagobah.
Yeah, it had a lot of really, really complementary and varied textures in terms of the art. If there was any of the three films I was going to play around in any other way, it would be that one.
That seems to be the biggest favorite. Is that kind of where your decision on that particular table came from?
I think it was more just because it was our most people's favorite Star Wars movie. And, you know, once we picked the film, then we started doing the table design and, you know, coming up with all the ideas for the layout and the missions and the toys and such. It wasn't, you know, there was some back and forth with Lucas on, mm-hmm. you know, what stuff they wanted to see, because, you know, every year they have, you know, a different film or character or whatever that they emphasize. And so, you know, you may see some of that going forward. Like, I think Yoda is this year, or maybe it's Darth Vader, I'm not sure. Anyway, they have a different emphasis. So there's some give and take. Like, we'll get one that we really want to do, and they'll have one that they really want us to do.
Oh, that's great. So this is a long-term deal with you and Lucas to continue to make tables then, right?
Yeah, we have, right now we're planning on a total of 10 tables, so two more three-packs, and then one standalone.
Oh, wow.
The tables take about 8 months to make, though, so there's going to be some, you know, several months in between each release.
Yeah, when you guys work on original tables, you know, ones that don't involve, you know, license like agents or paranormal, you know, stuff like that, how does the concept of one of those tables come about? For agents, you know, was someone just a fan of spy films or extreme, you know, was the skateboarding thing? How did those concepts come about?
It's the process has been different each time. I actually wasn't involved the first time. I was just doing consulting work with the Zen at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just themes that, you know, the studio manager wanted to do, or that he thought would be appealing. But now we have a whole process where we brainstorm, we do research on, you know, how many people would be interested in this sort of brand or, you know, this sort of theme.
For original tables and the licensed tables, how long does it take you to make just one table?
Between 6 and 8 months. It's kind of gravitated more towards the 8 months now that we've put a lot more work into production values and that kind of thing than we did early on. So it's taking a little bit longer than it used to.
Well, like, for instance, the Star Wars tables, did Lucas kind of open up their resources and their assets and just say, here's sound clips from the films, here's everything you need? Because I know you got the announcer guy from Clone Wars doing the narration, I suppose, whatever you want to call it, over the while you're playing the game. Did they open that up to you, or did you just have to, you know, get them from the films themselves? Or what kind of, how, in other words, how was that relationship like? Were they just completely, here, you have access to everything?
They're pretty hands-on. You know, they have approvals at every stage, and they did give us access to their the style guide and art assets and sound assets, and they also, for the new lines we had to record, they had a list of, you know, here's the guy who does this, here's the guy who does this other character, and you know, they're very insistent that we use those people.
We got a question from the chat room right now from Annie Aiko Coop. He's on my friends list on Xbox Live. He's currently holding. He's in the number one spot while I'm in the number two, and I'm currently chasing him at the moment. But he asked on table design, of all the tables, he says Mars seems to take the most liberties of virtual mechanics. Is there ever trouble when designing tables striking a balance between realistic elements and virtual ones?
Yeah, that's something that, you know, originally we were purely simulation with the original pinball effects tables.
Mm-hmm.
And now as we've gotten kind of more comfortable, we see with the audience how the audience responds when we, you know, do tables like a Mars or a Plants vs. Zombies. I think with the size of our collection now, the important thing is just to have variety.
You've got like 41 tables now, right?
It's something absurd. It's different on every platform, but yeah, we've got.
Right, I was only looking at I was only looking at Pinball Effects 2 on Xbox Live Arcade, and there's 40 some odd tables on that one alone. It's basically that's where I started playing you guys, so I just kind of added to that collection. It seems to be where I play the best there. That or the PS3. The Vita hasn't really. I like the layout that I can play with the Vita vertically, and have that feel of a table. But it hasn't yet set in on. I'm not as good playing on that as I would be on the 360 or the PS3. A couple of questions. Over on Reddit, I subscribe to their pinball subreddit, and I asked some questions there if people wanted to ask any. We got a few. One of them is, what do you think virtual table designers can learn from physical table designers, and vice versa?
Well, I mean, physical table designers are the people who created all the conventions of the genre. So, you know, if you're not following those conventions with, you know, there are ramps, there are shots at different angles, there's a set of flippers, you know, all those basic conventions,
mm-hmm.
you know, are things that you have to follow if you want to make a simulation style game. But the other thing is that these physical table designers were never happy just to create the same old stuff. They were always evolving and always trying to move the genre forward, you know, from, you know, score reels to electronic scoreboards to solid state electronics, play field toys, licenses, you know, all these things they brought in over the years. And so I think, you know, as a virtual table designer, you have to continue that or the genre is going to stagnate.
Well, I was going to say, they were, you know, being placed in arcades, they were competing with competing with all your flash of the screens. You know, of the electronic screens and the fighting games and whatever else, the racing games and everything else that was kind of taking the arcade, you know, your Mortal Kombat, your Street Fighters, that sort of thing. And so they had to somehow draw that attention. This is just me assuming. I don't know, but they had to draw that attention away and say, you know, we can hold your attention for a while, and we can. We're just on the same par as this as far as being an arcade staple, I suppose.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And that was, you know, the reason you have all these licenses and sights and sounds and such. And it used to be that video games had very simplistic graphics. And so pinball was much more real, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it obviously was a physical machine. But it was competing against very primitive visuals in video games. And then once the visuals of video games caught up and started being photorealistic, then pinball had to rely on other things to compete.
Another question we had from the subreddit was, what do you use to make your games, UDK, Unity, and also how can someone get a job working with Zen?
Well, we have a custom engine that we've built. We have a scripting system that's Python-based, but it's basically just built our own tools from the ground up. All the coding is done in C++. We use 3ds Max for the table geometry and texturing. Mm-hmm. As far as working at Zen, pretty much the entire company is located in Budapest, Hungary. There's only three of us, me, the creative director, the marketing VP, and our community manager, who are located outside of there. So you have to be willing to go to live in Budapest and work there.
Yeah, when I found that out the first time, I met with Mel at I met him in a hallway at E3. He was showing me an iPad game that he was working on, and I think he showed off the Thor table at the time. And it was the first time I'd ever met him. I was so excited because you guys, pinball again, it's just a huge passion of mine. And he said, "Oh, we're located out of Budapest." I said, "Oh." Because I was all excited about like the studios and everything else, and then it was like, oh wait, this is far away place. It's not actually located here, and that just really, really surprised me.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons we don't have some of these legendary physical pinball table designers working with us. Like, we'd love to work with them, but just the logistics, mm-hmm. and the cost difference between hiring people there and hiring people here. It is too great. But so if you want to work there and you're happy living in Budapest, then send in your resume to our company email.
It's a pretty small studio though, isn't it? How many people do you have there working on these tables?
We've grown quite a bit. We were about 10 people during the Pinball FX days, and now we're up to around 50.
Oh, nice.
We've got I think 6 pinball teams now working on pinball tables.
Are they divided into original, licensed, and other licensed properties? There's a set team that only works on the Marvel tables and a set team that only works on your original tables, or?
No, we like to move people around so people don't get stuck doing the same thing over and over again. It really saps your creativity when...
And everybody has to wear slippers, right? That's what you gave me a pair of them when I met you guys at E3. It's like, well, when you come into this booth, you have to take off your shoes and put on these slippers. So, and I thought, that's fine with me. Get some slippers out of them. What is, you guys have, talking about the Marvel tables, you guys have a great relationship with Marvel. What can we expect next from those tables? Are we going to get more movie character tie-ins? Are we going to get some comic book story arcs? Or what's next?
Well, right now we're focusing on Star Wars. We still have one Marvel table in the works, Doctor Strange. We don't have a projected release date for it right now, but the feedback we've gotten so far is that, again, people want variety, and so Marvel's already a pretty significant chunk of our collection. So right now we're just focusing on adding more variety to our collection, so the people who have had enough of Marvel will have some stuff to play as well.
Well, with that response, then what about the video game tie-in tables? You guys have Miss Explosion Man and Street Fighter; those were great. Any plans to base any more tables on any other games that already exist?
We don't have any in the works right now. We're talking to a few companies about that, but nothing to announce just yet. But that's definitely the kind of property that we're looking for, though.
And outside of Marvel and Star Wars, are there any new tables in the works from other licensed properties? And of course, outside of the video games as well. Anything in the licensed property section that we can expect?
We have a sports table coming. I can't give you details on it yet, but I can just tell you it's a sports table that we're working on.
Okay, not necessarily getting to, is it just based on a sport, or is it based on like a team from a sport?
It has licenses associated with it.
Okay. That'll be interesting. I'm not really a sports fan, but you integrate it with pinball, something that I am. I wonder. I don't know. I'm not a sports fan, and so I don't. But I like playing video games, but I don't play sports video games. So I'm interested to see how that will affect me, because I mean, it's still pinball. I'm still interested when it's pinball, even if it's a license that I'm not particularly interested in. Like I have nothing going back to physical tables. A table that I really, really want to play is the Apollo 13 table. You might know why, but it's got a 13 ball multi ball.
Yeah, that's a nightmare for the pinball repairman.
I would expect it would be, but that's kind of on my list of, you know, I have like a bucket list of pinball tables that I want to play, and Apollo 13 is on that list. What, speaking of favorites, what's your favorite physical table?
I'd have to go with Twilight Zone.
Oh, that's a good one.
Because I always wanted a gumball machine when I was a kid, and the table has a gumball machine.
That's a good one. That's one of those up there on the all-time list. I think there's an internet pinball database, and I think Twilight Zone is up there, and Addams Family, I think, is up there,
yeah,
as well.
Star Wars, Next Generation.
Mm-hmm. Very just good stuff there. What is your favorite table from the Zen collection?
Oh, I'd have to go with Sorcerer's Lair.
I own that table. I don't think I've played that table yet.
It's pretty similar to a real table. It doesn't have too much. You know, all the flash and unrealistic stuff is purely visual. So, and there's a lot to do. The table layout's clean, makes sense.
So it's from, you slap a year on it, what, from like the 70s designs? They kind of relied more on, you know, not ramps and whatever, the physical aspects of things, just getting the ball into a certain position, I guess. I'm not exactly sure what I'm trying to say, but those tables were a lot... The fields on those tables were a lot more barren, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's barren. I mean, it's definitely like a modern, solid-state 90s-type design,
mm-hmm.
but it's just, it doesn't look cluttered. And it's pretty easy to figure out what you need to do next. So I think it's a good table if you're just getting into our game to play that table. We give it away for free on iOS and Android. So if you download Zen Pinball on those platforms, you can play a full, no advertising version of Sorcerer's Lair for free.
Wonderful. Well, one last suggestion from the chat room. Coop says, make a Pac-Man table. Don't know how you can... There is a Pac-Man physical table that exists. I have not seen the layout of it and how it incorporates the game, but I'm just for more pinball, basically, is what I'm for. Neil, we want to thank you for your time, man. I appreciate you calling into the show and taking those questions. So thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
All right, well, have a great one, and we will talk to you later. Hopefully, you guys are going to be at E3 this year?
Maybe, if we have something to show. Then yes, but I think our games may be releasing before E3.
Well, so. You know what? There, one thing I wanted to ask you before we take a break here. Kickbeat, where are you guys at on that?
It's about a couple months out. We're just in beta now, finishing up the last few bugs.
Wonderful. Looking forward to it. Once again, thank you so much for being on the show. Really appreciate it.
All right, thanks.
That was Neil Sorens from Zen Studios. The Star Wars table packs are out now for Xbox Live Arcade, for PlayStation Vita, PlayStation 3, Google Play, iOS. It is all over the place, and you can pick them up wherever you play your virtual pinball table. When we come back, we're going to dive into some of the games we played. We've got one more mail letter to hit from the mailbag there, and it's all coming up next here on In-Game Chat. We'll be right back. Welcome back to In-Game Chat. This is the last segment of the show here, and we're going to jump right into one of the emails that we got. Mitch Strand, gamer accountant, as he likes to be known. Well, he doesn't. I don't know that he likes to be known as that, but he always lets us know that he's the gamer accountant. So that is his That's a superhero name now. Mitch Tran, gamer accountant. He writes to us and lets us know that he's found System of Shock 2 on GOG, and he is all over it. He says it was one of the last and best Looking Glass developed games. His buddy owned the game 13 years ago, and the first half hour was the most terrifying gameplay he had ever experienced. He says he will keep us posted on how it goes. 6 days later, we get an email from him. He writes back to us because he listened to an episode of the show from early 2010 when we mentioned that game had spiders in it. He is now in complete and constant fear while playing the game. We bring that up basically because James got into some System Shock today, I think.
Yeah, I played it today. As soon as it went on to GOG.com, as soon as that announcement was made and it was made available, I went and I picked that up. It was $10. I think we said this on a couple of episodes ago. It includes all of the... it essentially includes a roll-up of all of the updates based on some of the original source code that showed up in the second half of last year through sources unknown, and it is essentially the definitive version of System Shock 2 right now. Still, vanilla out of the box, even with GOG's version, is a little bit unlovely. So you'll want to mod it, but it's incredibly easy. It's incredibly easy to mod. GOG doesn't do anything particular with any of the games that they have on offer. Everything is as user friendly as it can possibly be. For the mod scene, this usually involves there simply being no barriers to modability. So there are essentially two things that you want to get. There's a texture upgrade pack, which just gives you cleaner, higher resolution textures on a lot of the some of the environment stuff, particularly anything readable, anything text-based, or anything with a lot of detail in it. And there is a special update pack for all of the meshes for the characters and everything. The characters in the original System Shock in System Shock 2 rather, were even at the time,
they were kind of
they
ugly.
Were magnificently ugly. They were terrible.
But that's what added to the crazy.
It was a little bit of uncanny valley before we were using that term to describe the dissociation, you know. But they were plenty scary. The new stuff is more or less in keeping with the design, the themes, kind of the idea going with the characters from, you know, 10, 12 years ago. But they're a little easier to look at, a little easier to understand. But I mean, look, it's a defining game. It's a really, really important game for a lot of us, and has been for a long time. And I've, as important as it's been, I've never really kind of thought too much about replayability. You know, I've gone back in a couple of times. It had a co-op mode and that we tried out, and it was really...
It was wonky.
It was wonky, and it isn't something that you should be doing anyway. That game is meant to be experienced alone. I just decided to load it up today on a lark because I couldn't figure out what else I wanted to play. I'm torn in too many different directions. I haven't actually tried that out yet. I was astonished at how playable it is, how completely, perfectly playable it still is. Most of the mechanics hold up perfectly well and are somehow still better than a lot of the things that have been derived from them, you know? The toggling between your inventory and your little point and click mode, you know, where you're doing your research, where you're listening to your logs, where you're analyzing the map and looking at all these different things, and the first person shooter esque segments is really, really sharp, really clean. And what got me most was it's maybe a little nonsensical for being set on a spaceship, but the level design is still really, really brilliant. It's got a lot of really cleverly designed line of sight tricks in it, and something that I realized just playing through the first area, spending about 90 minutes just in the first area, re-familiarizing myself with how it works. There were areas in there. There were things explicitly that I needed to access, stuff I needed to do. But I just know you're not going to do that now. Your hacking skill isn't good enough. You haven't done this thing or that thing. You haven't found this particular guy that's going to unlock this door, that's going to allow you to turn power back onto the elevator and all of that stuff. I have become so accustomed with modern design to completing an area, fulfilling everything that I have to do in that area, finding every secret, getting everything done, and then moving on, because that's how it works, right? You're supposed to finish every objective, then move on to the next set of objectives. This game isn't like that, and it took me minutes to really get comfortable with the idea that I will be coming back. I'll be moving back and forth. There will be things here that I can't do until later. That I don't want to say it's not exactly non-linearity, but that philosophy, that kind of design is really excellent. I really do wish that I can't even see the real impediment to doing that anymore. I don't know why.
Dead Space actually still does that, in my opinion, because there's many times
Which one? The first one didn't do that.
There was a couple of times, because I went back and I played through in prepping for 3. I beat 1 and 2 again. And there's sometimes on the Ishimura where you would... Well, actually, no. But once you get into the tram system...
Once you get onto the tram system, you were locked out. You couldn't move from place to place at will. You were the tool that your controllers were using to get things done in a particular place. You had no option to go where you wanted to go when you wanted to go there.
True. You did go back to some of the places later on.
Yes.
Like, you know, you go back to your ship that you first came in there, but yeah, you're right, it's not quite the same.
No. Hardly anybody's doing that anymore. BioShock didn't do it.
No.
So, I understand that everybody has a really dramatic and interesting story they want to tell, but the point being, System Shock 2 is still incredibly playable. It's still really, really tense. I know what was going to happen. I know that those hybrid monsters are going to be marching up and down the hallway. I know they're going to be there. I know what it sounds like when the door swishes open and closes as they walk by. I know what that first psychotic, crazy, telekinetic, fireball-shooting space monkey sounds like from the other room. That's like a thing. It's like an actual thing. I described it accurately.
He did.
I know. I'm just like, I'm going to have yakety sacks ready to go.
Yeah.
No, at a moment's notice to draw me out of that atmosphere.
But it was still amazingly tense. It still felt very sharp, very claustrophobic. And it was terrific. And still super playable. It looks the way it looks, but it's clean. You can play it at modern resolutions, and you could probably play this thing on just about any computer that's running right now. It's still a shame that more people haven't experienced it, because it's absolutely, you don't really have to do a whole lot to your expectations. You don't have to manage them into the ground in order to get over what it looks like or how it plays. It is perfectly familiar to anybody who's played anything modern, only it has a depth that isn't really represented.
Definitely post in the Steam group where people.
It's hardly obscure. There's essentially, if you looked up System Shock 2 mods, they would be the top two things that you find just about anywhere.
Cool. Well, we've got about 15 minutes left in the show here. We want to hit some quick news notes, I suppose.
Yeah, pick them up.
Well, let's see. We got some confirmation on two games being released this year on the PS3, Gran Turismo 6 and Beyond Two Souls. We didn't get a date for GT6.
But this year and on PS3, right?
Both
PS3. Of those things are confirmed. It's interesting now because the PS4 is announced, but there's still a handful of software titles out there that have been announced that didn't have dates, and there's been a bit of a question about, you know, anytime you get into the last year of a console's life cycle and you know that the new hardware's on the way, you start to wonder, like, is this Watch Dogs? They said that it was going to be on, you know, all of the current gen stuff, but they were still the better part of a year away from announcing the new hardware.
Mm-hmm.
And when they got around to it, they amended their original statement and said, it's for the new stuff,
right?
You know? But the new title from Quantic Dream, The Heavy Rain guys, it's what, Beyond Two Souls?
Beyond Two Souls.
Yeah.
And that it gets October 13th.
And
or
on
something?
PS3.
And on PS3, yeah.
Which really kind of makes you believe that...
PS3 exclusive.
Right. But it's not going to be made a PS4 title. And it just, it makes me really think that, okay, that's a date before which you could never expect the PS4.
Right.
Not that we would have. October's not that late in the year, but I think that lets us know that, you know, probably by that point we will have seen just about all of the major PS3 titles.
Yeah, that'll be its swan song, so to speak, as far as its big release.
That would be a good one, I imagine. If it's even half of what it's cracked up to be.
Yeah, I think it will be, and so should be. So you know, that's when we're thinking the PS4 will hit. It's going to be sometime after that, obviously, but not before. So. What was another thing there? We saw that the, Xbox Live's having a game sale.
They're having a really interesting game
they
sale.
They are.
Have you guys looked at it?
I've been watching it every day just to see, not necessarily if games, because most of the time I already have the game or have played it and sent it back to GameFly.
Right. If you'd like to own it, you'd really rather own it on the PC.
Right, because, you know, I saw Dishonored pop up there today, and I'm like, ooh, that's... You know, $30. It's the same price on the PC, at least during a Steam sale.
It's not the first time they've had a sale. We should be clear. This is on their Games on Demand service, which is essentially their digital storefront for all of their main games. It's not arcade. This is the
retail games on demand.
The retail games on demand front end. And it's very interesting because it's maybe not the broadest sale in the world. They don't have a huge number of games available, but what they have is pretty significant, and the price cuts are actually
pretty deep.
They're very deep. Percentage-wise, they look just like a Steam sale today. You know, and they're running it a lot like a sale managed by any of the guys who sell PC games digitally. They have things that are persistent throughout the entire week, and then they have special deep discounts on an individual day. Today they have, what is it, Dishonored and Borderlands 2.
Borderlands 2.
And for like $30.
Yeah.
And those are both games that are only a couple months old.
I'm personally mainly keeping my eye out for the DLC that I would always skip on some of these titles and say, ooh, that's a good price, I'll pick it up now. But I think it's, you know, we don't bring this up because we do, I suppose, as a public service to you guys to say, hey, keep your eye out on some of this stuff, but I guess it's more to look at the testing of the waters that they seem to be going into.
They have shown no interest in aggressive and competitive pricing on their digital front end.
Right.
They haven't. They are one of the groups of people who have simply said, this is the price. This is the price. The price is the price, whether it's at brick and mortar retail or you know, as a digital download, which is absurd. It's ridiculous.
How often do those prices ever drop?
They don't.
Yeah.
They don't. And there's a lot of arguments to be made that they each buoy the other, you know? As long as there are these kinds of things not changing, then these kinds of things are going to continue to not change. And as long as used copies exist, they keep new prices high. Stuff like that. But in this sale, I'm not saying I agree to any of that, but it's a complicated discussion. And they haven't entered the fray at all. And then when they do it, frankly, completely right.
Yeah.
And some of these, the real kicker is, on the PC, you're never pricing against a used copy because they don't exist. On the console, that had to be a consideration for the first time Microsoft decided to try this sales scheme. And in a lot of these cases, it totally steals the thunder from anybody selling these things used. A used copy of Dishonored, I didn't look it up, but it occurred to me that maybe I could, because you can see those prices on, say, GameStop's website.
Probably about 50?
I wouldn't say, maybe 45, 40, something like that. Nothing near 30.
Yeah, I think you're probably being conservative with that price, just giving them the benefit of the doubt on that. But, I mean, I completely understand what you're saying. They have got to... They have more people to compete with. They're not trying to compete with the PC sales on this.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
But they are trying to compete with rentals, used games, and individual retailer discounts and pricing incentives that the retailers have. So, like trade-ins and stuff like that. They have to find a way to just say, how likely are you to buy this? You know? Are they testing the waters for something later? Are they maybe competing against the idea that their digital downloads are possibly not going to translate forward?
Yeah, I'd love to see. And I don't think we get any numbers on this. I mean, I know we get the numbers that come out every month on how well that month did in games, but I don't think we get any numbers from something like their digital distribution service.
Almost nobody gives real numbers about that. I should. I, if I were to guess, I would say that we're less likely to see a problem in backward compatibility with digital stuff for Microsoft than we are with Sony. I mean, Sony had to bite a bullet on that in order to change the nature of what the PS4's hardware is going to be. The Xbox is unlikely to have that problem, so you're probably safe at this point doing that. I think it's pretty clear that what they're doing is they're testing a new distribution mechanism.
It was one of the things I wanted to ask Neil, but really couldn't, because I knew that even if he was allowed, or even if he already knew the answer, he was not allowed to say it. But I've got 41 tables, pinball tables, mm-hmm. from their game. That's a lot of money wrapped up into that thing. But my concern was, are these tables going to come with me for my next generation?
Yeah,
you know, and I know that he, even if he knew, he wouldn't be able to tell me. But
That question right there, posed maybe a little different, depending on your circumstance, is one of probably three key questions about moving to whatever these guys are going to try to get us to buy in a few months.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to be particularly loose with those facts, I don't think. But in any case, it doesn't really matter. The console guys, the guys, you know, who they just don't want to build a PC as much as they hear people like us talk about the advantages of sales, which is a huge advantage. It's awful nice to just be able to go on their storefront and say, yeah, you know, $10 for Fable 3, that's pretty cool. And it's not a used copy. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't have greasy fingerprints.
Torn up manual.
Torn up manual, scratch disc face, anything like that. It's, you know, It may be a good opportunity at a low barrier to entry, because it's relatively cheap, to try out something they've never done before, which is, you know, digital ownership of a complete game. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I basically don't see anything wrong with it at all. It's nothing but right, and I hope they continue to do it.
Yeah. We've only got a few more minutes left. Matt, you have finished Dead Space 3?
I have.
And your opinion?
It's a lot different from the first two, just in terms of gameplay and mechanics.
I've not heard good things about Dead Space 3.
It was okay.
Yeah.
It was okay isn't really something you should... That's not what I want to hear.
I know.
It's a bad review. It's okay is a bad review.
Before I played Dead Space 3, I went through the first two again, and even with the first one, I was still, you know, intense, even though I was doing the new game plus with my super, you know, tough Isaac Clarke with all the, you know, weapons and everything like that. I did that for one and two, and, you know, yeah, I'm overpowered, but I'm still kind of tense playing through this. This one, the scares were more like jump out, startle kind of scare, so they weren't really that scary.
Not very atmospheric then?
Not really. I do like how you start off in space, but then eventually you go to an ice planet, and at that point it was just... it was alright. I mean, I played through it, and I don't know.
Well, I knew you weren't going to be here next week for next week's show, and we had talked about that before. I believe RJ has played it as well. I don't know that he's going to be here next week either, but you know, if he is... We'll get his opinion on it and you know, compare the two of you.
It just seems to me, based on what I've heard, that they lost the thread of what made the first game great, the second game pretty good.
Okay. Yeah, this one, it just didn't quite capture me like the other two did.
And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't even about the fear. I didn't even find the first one to be... It had some good atmospheric scares.
It was unsettling.
But it was also mostly... It was mostly jump scares as well. But it had a little bit of... kind of psychological trickery in it. The second one had a bit more psychological malice. But I thought they were both really, really fun. I thought they were really, really good, but they managed in just about every way, through at the very least advertising and showing me what they had on offer from the third game, to tell me that the things I found most rewarding from the first two, they weren't interested in putting into the third. So that's a shame.
It is. But anyway, so you won't be here next week, Matt.
No.
But and we don't know about Jeremy. We don't know about RJ. Dennis, of course, hopefully. He'll probably be in the chat room.
He'll be in the chat room.
But we would love it if he could be here on the show with us, and we'll try to get him in here for that as well. Is there anything left to say before we go? Anything you want to hit? We've got about 4 minutes left in the show.
I don't mind saying, really looking forward to Tomb Raider.
Me too.
On Tuesday.
Tomb Raider is Tuesday. SimCity is Tuesday.
That's tough. What are you going to do? There's no rental or console option on SimCity. You have you have to decide whether or not you're willing to take what EA insists that you deal
with.
The
Ultimate Edition.
Well, no, I mean, it's the nature of that game and what it's going to be, something that you're willing to deal with. It's very tempting, but I don't think I'm going to participate. I'm going to have to wait about it. I'm going to have to wait and see what people who have actually bothered to spend the money say about how EA is managing that game.
I suppose I'm more interested in playing Tomb Raider because I know that will be something that we'll have all played. You know, I have access to play that as a rental. You have access to play that
and
as a rental.
And you've played which among the Tomb Raiders? I'm sorry.
I played all of the newer...
You've played everything modern since the reintroduction
Legend.
On...
Since Legend, Anniversary, and Underworld.
Okay.
Those are the three I played. I did not play Guardians of Light. I really, you know, that's sort of a side project on Tomb Raider type stuff, but I did not play that. But the newer, the modern versions of...
And you played Anniversary, so at least you have some...
Yeah, yeah.
Some idea of the about beginnings. What was happening a long time ago.
Right, yeah, exactly.
So. I played all of them except for Chronicles and The Last Revelation.
I can't even remember. I watched the retrospective. I can't even remember what all I've done. I think I have a really cheap copy of Underworld that I never got around to playing. Played a little bit of Anniversary. You know, it was cute, but I've already been there. I liked Legend a lot.
That was a really good one.
So we'll see how this goes. It's an enormous departure. For what they're trying to do.
But, I mean, the reviews came out.
They were
early.
Yeah, I mean, I expected the game to be, you know, it was worth a romp, but they released their games. The embargo for the review was, what, a week ago at this point almost.
Yeah.
And they are, on the whole, really, really positive. They don't seem to really be any outliers. I can't cut away the high and the low. And I can't look for somebody who's released it way early while everybody else has to wait for a day of embargo. So all of the normal rules for deciding that the reviews don't matter, the game is probably sort of stinky anyway, don't apply. I wasn't shocked, but I was sort of pleasantly surprised to see that it's, you know, nines.
I was kind of happy for it, honestly. I was like, oh, good. You know, I'm glad
good
this
on
is, yeah, exactly. I'm glad this isn't something that I mean, it had the possibility to go horribly wrong.
Yeah.
And I'm glad to see that it kind of made it through the other side somewhat unscathed.
This is the second
ownership.
This is the second very Western property that's been relaunched under the new Square Enix that has turned out fairly well. Deus Ex and this. So here's hoping. Let's keep our fingers crossed for Thief.
Well, that is going to do it for this episode of In-Game Chat. Join us next week. We've got Ty Taylor. He is the creator of a game on Steam right now called The Bridge. We'll have copies to give away and an interview with him. That's all next week. Hey, folks, you might have noticed that the podcast got cut off here. The recording equipment, for whatever reason, stopped. There wasn't much after this. Just see you next week, and thanks for listening. So we're going to leave it at that. We'll see you next week, and thanks for listening.